tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Your host, Donna Wolf, is out. My name is Ebony Johnson, co-hosting here. And the first day of fall equinox to everyone. And we have the pleasure of being in the studio with two gentlemen who produced a documentary that I was able to see and was delighted to see. Lyle Gibson, Chair of Social Science Division and Professor of History at Metropolitan Community College, and Jermaine Thomas, producer, director, editor, and founder of Tashi Studios. They are in the studio with me to discuss their recent documentary, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. Welcome to KKFI and Urban Connections, gentlemen.
Thank you, and thank you for having us.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Okay. So, tell Kent, for those people in Kansas City who do not know and have not heard of Legacy Spirit of the Black Panthers, what is it? How did we get here? Why'd you do it? But start off with what the documentary is about.
Legacy Spirit of the Black Panthers is a documentary that chronicles the efforts and the plight of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers.
Okay. Anything you want to add, Lyle?
Yeah, it's in addition to that, it really explores not only the broader history of why the original Black Panther Party was founded in 1966 in Oakland, California, but really it explores some of the whys, some of the things that were birthed out of the movement. And then also the film kind of ends with the legacy or the continuation of what's going on today in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was appealing for me, especially as a Kansas City native, is that we were a part of that too, very much a part of the, and that too, I mean, the Black Panther story, you know, right here in Kansas City. And not, I mean, I've seen documentaries and various interviews about the Black Panthers as a whole, but the focus, you know, was on Bobby Seale or, you know, or L.A. or what have you. And to hear about Pete O'Neill and to hear about Charlotte O'Neill and the various casts that you have in this film makes me feel closer to the experience and say, you know, I started questioning, like, even within my family, hey, did you know that we had a Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers? Were you a part of it? Was it on the news? What was going on? So can you talk about your experience in gathering material to make this documentary and I guess how available the information was, or, you know, if many people really were that active and involved in Kansas City?
Well, the information was actually easy because Charlotte kept such detailed history.
Okay.
You know, pictures, articles, and things of that nature.
And then also, just for our audience, Charlotte O'Neill, Pete O'Neill's wife.
Pete O'Neill's wife. And then Lyle, who's also a history professor, you know, also helped with some of the research and things of that nature. But I think that's what drew people to the film, is learning that within the broader scope of the Panthers, that there was a local chapter doing things, you know, in the community, whether it was teaching people how to read or giving out sickle cell anemia testing, giving out breakfast programs. And so now here's the funny part. You really want to hear something ironic. I went to Job Corps with a young lady named Ann from 92 to 94. We was good friends, you know, right? It was not until later on in years that I realized that the girl was actually Pete O'Neill's daughter.
Oh, yes.
So,
yeah.
I did not. So she, one day in just passing, you know, we was talking, and I said, and she was talking about her dad, and I said, Pete O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you mean the Black Panther people? She's like, yes, that's my father. And I'm like, so all this time I've been sitting around joking with a legend's door. But it was, and then I finally got to meet her mother. And the film came about because they was having a celebration of the overall Black Panther Party. And so as I sat with Miss O'Neill, you know, and she started talking about the Kansas City chapter, you know, I didn't know how deep it was. And so finally I said, Mr. O'Neill, this needs to be a documentary. And so I got all excited, and I was like, yeah, we can do this. And then finally Ben was like, well, how are you going to pay for it?
Yeah. And that always the question, right?
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, all right. And so then I talked to Mr. Gibson, because I had actually went through that process before with my first film, Black Tie, White Tie, which is based on a book that Mr. Gibson wrote. And so that's really how the film came up, how the idea, the genesis of the film came about. And so Lyle, who's really good at logistics and really good at putting things together, you know, I sat with him and talked, and we kind of detailed out, you know, how the film should go from a historical standpoint. Because I came to find out that a lot of people did not know that there was a chapter here.
Okay, you know? So that was your, because at first I was thinking, well, how involved was my family in the, you know, aware of things that were going on necessarily with social, you know, and political things and happening in Kansas City, but your greater experience was the same thing, not, okay.
And the funny part was, me and Lyle, we, for months, we put out, you know, we put out ads, and we was like, if anybody's associated, you know, with the Black Panther Party, please let us know. We're doing this documentary. We want to interview you. So we found out about, I can never get her name.
Andre Weatherby Ross,
and then
Errol Brown.
Now, here's the funny part. Every time we have a screening, somebody always come up and says, you know, my mom helped out with the breakfast program, you know. And they, or they'll say, yeah, you know, my mom hung around and they helped pass out paraphernalia and things of that nature. And I was like, well, where were these people when we was
trying to get it done?
But it was good, so.
Yeah, and I think, too, when we look at the broader aspect to your question, a lot of it has to do with the traditional aspect of our oral history as it pertains to our African roots. And for a host of reasons, we're not conveying the oral history like we should or like we used to. And so I'm the same way. I really didn't, you know about the Black Panther Party per se until I hit college, because you didn't see it in textbooks. And then I didn't know of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party until probably, I would say, in the 90s. And then I heard about Pete O'Neill, and just so happened I was teaching a history class. It was in the evening during the summertime. And there, he had a niece that was in my class, but we didn't know of the connection until she just kind of mentioned it in passing. Oh, yeah, by the way, my uncle is, you know, in Tanzania. So I think that's part of the challenge within the African-American community. We have to convey the oral history of the community so that each generation is aware. And to give an example of passing down information, my administrative assistant was sharing with me after we had a screening at MCC Penn Valley a couple of days ago that her youngest son in elementary school was taught by a former Panther.
Wow.
And so, you know, one son wasn't, but the other son was. And so how can we make sure that we convey these oral histories even with people who were in their 20s who may have been introduced to, you know, aspects of our African-American history and culture, like the Black Panthers? They have to be taught to continue to pass that information on and convey that information.
Yeah.
So
with that being said, for, you know, for folks and even some younger folks who are listening and are saying, well, who is Pete O'Neill? Give us that introduction to the degree that you can.
Like I said, I went to school with his daughter, and I actually have more. Well, I guess the easiest way to put it was, Pete was the was one of the founders of the Kansas City chapter. They actually had to go to L.A. to get the charter to actually open up a chapter here. It just wasn't, as you were hearing the film, she says, just wasn't a thing that was loosely put together. They actually had to go to California and sit with Huey and Bobby and get
permission. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, founders.
and get permission to charter a chapter here. So when they came back, that's when they stood, I think it was down on City Hall, and they announced that, you know, the Black Panther Party was here, you know, they was going to be watching the police, and they had a big rally down there. And so for me, he's one of the people that's the founder of that particular movement here in Kansas City. And whether people know it or not, that group itself, it was just as important as a movement as the worldwide and the one in California. So,
and two, with Pete O'Neill wanting to address the same issues that were happening in other major metropolitan areas across the country. So it was really, Kansas City was just a microcosm of what was going on nationally. And so, like I said, about a year later or so in 1967, that's when, you know, they received permission from the Oakland chapter to go ahead and start a chapter here in Kansas City. And the interesting thing, too, I think this is important within the context of Kansas City history. It's also a few months later, by April of 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated, we had our riots. And so, you know, the Panther Party was able to kind of use that also as a platform to address some of the social ills that were happening in society.
And if you're just tuning in, you are listening to the Urban Connection Show here on 90.1 FM. Donna Wolf, your host, is out. My co-host, Ebony Johnson, here in studio live with Lyle Gibson, professor of history and chair of social science division at Metropolitan Community College, and Jermaine Thomas, producer, director, and editor, and founder of Tashi Studios. We're talking about their most recent project, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers, a documentary that focuses on the Black Panthers and specifically the Kansas City chapter. Can you talk to us about Pete O'Neill today? And the documentary shows him in Tanzania. First, can you share for those who do not know why he left the United, how and why he left the United States, and what he's doing in Tanzania now?
Yes, there was a trumped-up weapons charge. Actually, Pete O'Neill and his wife Charlotte have been in Africa since, in exile in Africa since 1972. There was a trumped-up weapons charge crossing the state line. However, there was question or not whether the weapon was actually in the car. But as a result, Pete O'Neill and his wife had to leave the country. They first went to North Africa and then eventually making their way into Tanzania and East Africa. But many people question whether or not he should have been arrested for that, because there were some infractions, I would say, during his teenage years where things should have been expunged. And so there was kind of a carryover. But once again, it kind of exposed some of the corrupt practices or the ill practices of the criminal justice system. And so as a result, like I said, they had to flee the United States and move to Africa. But the interesting thing is, as they moved to Africa, they realized that this Black Panther Party movement was really not just a movement in the United States. It really turned into a global movement. So,
in what way?
Well, it's something we hint on in the documentary, but there were global or worldwide revolutions taking place. And anytime you have a people who are marginalized, or, you know, they feel as though they don't have the full access to whatever constitutional privileges there are within a given country, typically you see the young people rise up and revolt. And so truly we started to see global revolutions take place. But we also have to put this within context. And another thing that we talk about a little bit in the documentary is that within the context of the United States, it was during the Cold War in which we had a nuclear arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union. So the United States was trying to prevent the spread of communism globally.
One of the, Jermaine, did you have anything to add?
They're still, the thing that really strikes me is they took the model that they were using here and applied it in Tanzania. So they have schools and computer classes, and they even have exchange programs where students from here have actually went there and they climbed, I think, what is it, Mount Kilimanjaro? Mm-hmm. And, they have a lot of things going on over there, so.
And they also take in their foster parents to children, orphan children, and I can't remember the number, but I mean it's several dozen children
yeah.
that they have taken in and just helped to nurture them and watch them grow into adulthood. So.
And Charlotte O'Neill, Pete O'Neill's wife, she still travels back and forth, correct?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes,
okay.
She travels back and forth. Matter of fact, that's already happened. Every year, she does a Heal the Community tour where she travels the world, and she's a musician now. Matter of fact, some of her music is in the film.
Okay.
So she comes here, she starts off here, and she visits her daughter, then she begins to heal the community, heal the world, heal the community tour.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the other people that are highlighted in the documentary, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. Katrina Faye Webster, Andre Weatherby Walls, Steve Penn. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Andre Weatherby Walls was another member of the Kansas City chapter. She's actually, pretty soon she'll be moving to Chicago. I got her through actually Mama C, and it took a while because she doesn't do a lot on Facebook. I actually got her through social media.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's like very old school. So mm-hmm. when I finally called her, she gave me her number. But she studies law now, and she teaches, so that's what she does. And her main thing, one thing I learned from her, the beauty of this is when you sit with all of them, you learn, but you see like different aspects. Like she was talking to me about how whatever it takes to reach the young people, that's what you do.
Mm.
Like you don't try to put them into a mold. If music is how you reach them, then you use music.
Mm-hmm.
If art is how you reach them, then you use art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if science or mathematics or whatever it takes to reach the youth, and not just reach them, but to teach them their history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as Lyle alluded to earlier, we have to be more vigilant as far as our oral history. So her thing was whatever it takes for you to reach those young people, you know, you have to meet them. And they do that. And Mama seen them actually do that. Like they'll teach the kids music, mathematics, or whatever it takes to get these kids, to learn their history. So that was really good.
And Steve Penn is a writer, has a book out, and I apologize, I cannot remember the name off the top
Case
of my head.
Case for Pardon.
Case for Pardon, thank you. He was, he's been involved with the O'Neill family for quite some time, and we did have interview footage of Steve Penn, mm-hmm. but when we came to the final edit, it just didn't piece together
okay.
with the narrative that we
mm-hmm.
were trying to convey. Also with Katrina, she this was something that Jermaine had envisioned. I'll let him talk about that a little bit.
Well, she did this poem, and once we get to either the DVD or the final print of the film, she did this poem called Can You See the Pride in the Panther?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that poem was really, it really summed up the film. And I chose her to do that because when I sat with Mama C, one of the things she wanted to hit home, because at that time when she came, there was this new Black Panther Party that was coming in.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody had this idea, all the Panthers, they were racist, they were fanatical and all this. And Mama C, she said, just make sure that you get across the idea, when we say power to the people,
mm-hmm.
we mean all the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, red power to red people, black power to black people, white power to white people, all power to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted that message to get across.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put out this idea of what I wanted to do, I met Katrina and she came in. And her and a few other kids came and read, but I told her, I said, if you can find a black beret, that'd be real cool.
Yeah.
So she found something like that. And when she did the poem, was you there?
Mm-hmm.
When she did the poem, I really liked it. So I just need to figure out where I'm going to put it in the final cut. But
okay.
I chose her because I wanted, Then Mama C liked it because, like I said earlier, she really wanted to get home this idea of all power to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said earlier, and I actually had somebody to reach out to them, and they was like, well, it wasn't the Panthers or racist terrorist group. And mm-hmm. that really got to me, because I cannot see how you can put the word terrorist
mm-hmm.
alongside of a group who was advocating self-help.
Yeah.
You know, they only picked up weapons for self-defense.
Right.
You know, they wasn't going out trying to brutally kill cops or do anything mm-hmm. or cause unrest.
And weapons in response to people who had weapons, were you misusing weapons against their own people.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so when this guy, came to me and said, well, weren't they a terrorist organization? You know, I asked him, I was like, where did you get this information from?
Mm-hmm.
Because being a student of Lyle's history class, the one thing he always tells us, you know, you need to follow the trail back to where, you know, where information comes from and put things in this historical context. So I actually wanted the guy to be in the film, but he declines.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For me, that was the most important thing, the message to get out, is that, you know, the Panthers, you know, wasn't about trying to go out and cause any violence, but rather to take what they had and help build their communities. Because if mm-hmm. you look what they did Braxton School programs, sickle cell anemia testing, political education classes. And Charlotte even said guys was coming in there that couldn't even read.
Mm-hmm.
But because they wanted to be part of the movement, they learned how to read.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall or something just to been there, to be there to see that. And to see them take that same formula and apply it in Tanzania, mm-hmm. it's even better.
Yeah. You mentioned the poem that you want to include in the final edit for Legacy Spirit of the Black Panthers. And we just had you probably didn't hear it, Kansas City, but OG from OG Hangout. Oh my gosh, I can see it. So he's on Wednesdays. Anyways, he brought in a poem from Nikki Giovanni about Aretha Franklin. And so it's kind of hot off the press. We're going to take a break and give this a listen. I didn't know he was bringing this specific one in for me today, but we'll see what we got here. And then we'll come back and continue our conversation about legacy and the spirit of the Black Panthers with Lyle Gibson, professor of history and chair of social science division at Metropolitan Community College, and Jermaine Thomas, producer, director, editor, and founder of Tashi Studios. You're tuned here to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Ebony Johnson, and you're here on the Urban Connection Show. And we'll be back after this break.
Nobody knows.
'Cause nobody deals with Aretha, a mother with four children, having to hit the road. They always say after she comes home, but nobody ever says what it's like to get on a plane for a three-week tour. The elation of the first couple of audiences, the good feeling of exchange, the running on the high you get from singing good and loud and long, telling the world what's on your mind. Then comes the eighth show on the sixth day, the beginning to smell like that plane or bus. The if you forget your toothbrush in one spot, you can't brush until the second show. The strangers pulling at you 'cause they love you, but you having no love to give back. The singing the same songs night after night, day after day. And if you read the gossip columns, the rumors that your husband is only after your fame. The wondering if your children will be glad to see you, and maybe the not caring if they are. The scheming to get out of just one show and go just one place where some dodo doopity-doop won't say, just sing one song, please. Nobody mentions how it feels to become a freak because you have talent, and how no one gives a damn how you feel, but only cares that Aretha Franklin is here. Like maybe that'll stop chickens from frying eggs from being laid, or crackers from hating. And if you say you're lonely, or scared, or tired, how they always just say, "Aw, come off it," or, "Did you see how they loved you? Did you see, huh, did you?" Which most likely has nothing to do with you anyway. And I'm not saying Aretha shouldn't have talent, and I'm certainly not saying she should quit singing. But as much as I love her, I'd vote yes to her doing 4 concerts a year and staying home or doing whatever she wants and making records, because it's a shame the way we're killing her. We eat up artists like there's going to be a famine at the end of those 3 minutes, when there are, in fact, an abundance of talents just waiting. Let's put some of the giants away for a while and deal with them like they have a life to lead. Aretha doesn't have to relive Billie Holiday's life, doesn't have to relive Donna Washington's death. But who's going to stop the pattern? She's more important than her music if they must be separated. And they should be separated when she has to pass out before anyone recognizes she needs a rest. And I say I need Aretha's music. She's undoubtedly the one person who put everyone on notice. She revived Johnny Ace and remembered Lil Green. Aretha sings "I Say a Little Prayer," and Dion doesn't want to hear it anymore. Aretha sings "Money Won't Change You," but James Brown can't sing "Respect." The advent of Aretha pulled Ray Charles from Marlboro country and back into the blues, made Nancy Wilson try one more time, forced Dion to make a choice. She opted for the movies, and Diana Ross had to get an Afro wig. Pushed every black singer into blackness and Negro entertainers into Negroness. You couldn't jive when she said, "You make me feel." The Blazers had to reply, "Gotta let a man be a man." Aretha said, "When my show was in the lost and found, you came along to claim it." And Janis Joplin said, "Maybe." There has been no musician whom her very presence hasn't affected. When Humphrey wanted her to campaign, she said, "A woman's only human." And he pressured James Brown. They removed Otis Redding because the combination was too strong. The Impressions had to say, "Lord have mercy, we're moving on up." The black songs started coming from the singers on stage and the dancers in the streets. Aretha was the riot, was the leader. If she had said, "Come, let's do it," it would have been done. Temptations say, "Why don't we think about it, think about it, think about it."
And we are back here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. That was courtesy of Mr. Groovy Grant from OG's Hangout on Wednesdays. He came in and brought that in for us to share here on the Urban Connection Show. Our guest today, again, is Lyle Gibson, professor of history at Metropolitan Community College, and Jermaine Thompson, founder of Tashi Studios. We're talking about their most recent collaborative project, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers, a documentary that focuses on the spirit of the Black Panthers and the Kansas City chapter, highlighting Pete O'Neill as one of the founders of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers. Something that is brought up in the title of this documentary and also within the narration is that the Black Panthers had a spirit of service. We've talked too about the breakfast programs and health initiatives and wanting to have self-defense. And Jermaine, you mentioned someone you met who thought that the Black Panthers were a terrorist group. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you mean by spirit of service and how you chose to convey this in this documentary?
One of the things when me and Mama C sat down and we had a conversation about this film, she even talks about it in the interview where she says when she went down, and the main thing that drew her was the community service, the things that these guys was doing in the community. And when you have a people that don't have access, you can only do one or two things. You can either beg or you can do it yourself. Mm. You know, Pac said in the interview one time, and I think this sums it up, he said, "If I'm hungry and I come by and I peek in your door and see you eating, right,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to knock the first time,
mm-hmm.
right? And he said, the second time I come through, you know, it's going to be a little bit more forceful knock.
Yeah.
And if you ignore me the third time, I'm coming in with guns blazing." But he said it to demonstrate the fact that, because I think his mama was a Panther as well, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he said that to demonstrate the fact that, you know, and Mr. Gibson talks a lot about this in the film, you know, this idea of self-help.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, when you're in a situation like that, there's only two possibilities. Either you can sit and beg, or you can figure out a way to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing about, like Mr. Gibson said, you know, when there's a movement, there's always young people.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the idea, okay, we're just going to keep begging the government.
Right.
They was like, look, kids need to eat before breakfast. Let's go get some food and feed them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or they need to be clothed. We need to get them clothed.
Mm-hmm.
Look, they need sickle cell testing, flu shots or whatever. Let's get them. And I was amazed to find out that even today there is still a Panther clinic that is in operation. I think it's in North Carolina or
something. Yeah, I think it's on the East. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's still in operation. So mm-hmm. this idea... When I was trying to come up with the idea of the name of the documentary, the celebration was the legacy celebration when she came here. And so I was playing around with different things, and I sent Lyle an email, and I said, Lyle, what do you think, legacy, spirit of the Black Panthers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lyle was like, yeah, that's cool. And so I sent it to Mama C, and Mama C was like, that's it. You know, so she always wanted this idea of community service. And this idea of community service interwoven throughout the film,
mm-hmm.
because that's still what they do even in Tanzania today.
One of the things, as Jermaine, you're saying, Mama C, Charlotte O'Neill, mm-hmm. for those of us who don't know her that way, she talked about seeing levels of socialism with community gardens and various ways that people are coming together. She, in the documentary, I recall her saying, to be able to barter, you know, and trade and exchange is a very natural thing for people to do. And sometimes, especially in a capitalistic society, when people start talking about socialism, that sounds like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? It sounds like a threat. But to her point, people naturally, we do that in families. We do that, like, it is a natural thing. This is what I have to offer, and so let me put that on the table. And then everybody else brings what they have to offer naturally, and put that on the table. So I've enjoyed hearing her talk about socialism in that way and tying it to seeing community gardens in various ways that communities are coming together to nourish themselves.
You know, one of the things when she talked about that within that context, that tradition is as old as mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I learned when I went to Senegal several years ago is that within the community, the village, whatever you want to call it, no one really goes without.
Yeah.
And so there's this spirit of mutual benefit, so that, you know, everyone has access to food or the resources that they need. And that's really what Mama C was conveying in the film. But even when we look at our own history as African Americans, mm-hmm. right after slavery, it's about what resources do we have where we can start to work together,
mm-hmm.
where it's mutually beneficial. And you're right. Today, you know, when you say socialism, that's like a negative word.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't understand historically mankind, you know, when we had families and communities before mankind left Africa.
Mm-hmm. Come on now.
We were working together. And so we need to really find a way to get back to that. And one thing, too, that I want to mention that's very important to this discussion, you know, I went with a group of educators to Senegal back in 99. And that's one of the things that we noticed immediately. There was really no daycare system.
Mm.
That's because all the children were being taken care of by members of the community,
mm.
you know. There was no senior living facilities.
Yeah.
That's because all of the elders were being taken care of by members of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, we have to really step back and just ask fundamental questions about capitalism versus, hey, how can we find ways to take care of one another?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I find that interesting because I, you know, when I started doing documentary films, I started watching a lot of documentaries. And there's a documentary on Netflix. This is a series by Tom Hanks, and they go through each 10-year period, you know, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, or whatever. So during the time what they call the hippie movement or whatever, they was talking about this idea of socialism, right? Mm-hmm. And I learned something because, you know, you hear people say, well, they was just a bunch of lazy kids that didn't want to do nothing. But actually what they were doing was what Mama C was talking about. You know, they was taking care of the kids and bringing food. And one of the guys said the thing that killed it was people that was coming in that wasn't contributing. Mm-hmm. You know, they started having people that were stealing and, mm-hmm. you know, and it was just crazy how they broke down. But, you know, eventually he said they realized that experiment, you know, it wouldn't last. But it was kind of sad to see that, you know, here's you have a group of young people that are trying. And then you have somebody else come in and mm-hmm. say, well, you know, how can I undermine this or how mm-hmm. can I take care of myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And all you had to do was contribute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wasn't asking for a lot. You know, if you came in, you know, maybe you wash clothes or you cook food, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's got to be something fundamentally wrong when you come in with this idea that you don't want to contribute.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can add too, be mindful of the person who states, I did this myself.
Right.
I built this myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the type of person, I'm standing on the shoulders of all my ancestors.
Yeah.
You know, I'm standing on the shoulders of members of my community.
Right.
You know, because they put something in me.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's my turn to make sure that I'm putting something back into the lives of other people, especially through teaching. That's what I do. But that's a part of, you know, working together in a social network.
You know, and it's funny that you say that because when we was doing Black Tie, White Tie, and I was interviewing you and your mom, you know, at the table, and as I was watching.
Jermaine, tell us what Black Tie, White Tie is.
That's the first film I did. It's based on actually Lyle Gibson's book of the same name.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was interviewing him and his mom, she said the same thing. She tried to impart to him the lessons that she was taught,
mm-hmm.
you know, as far as, you know, like giving back to the community, because his whole family is full of teachers and preachers. So I thought that was like really interesting. So, and you can see that when you interview his family, but I think that's really important. And I think that's one of the things that we're missing, especially within the Black community.
Mm-hmm. I feel as though having this conversation and conversations that I have with my own siblings and people in my family, we're getting back to that though, because we feel and know very painfully so that we come from that, and that's something that we really want to get back to, because everybody getting up to work more and more and more and more hours just to make it or just to have a little bit more, it's not satisfying. You know what I mean? It's not enough. It doesn't allow for us to really enjoy living, you know, if you will. And in that vein, one of the things that Pete O'Neill talks about in the documentary Legacy Spirit of the Black Panthers is reparations. And he just speaks about how can, you know, if a group of people have contributed their labor for hundreds of years to help the advancement of an entire country, and that and the people who benefited from that advanced further and further along, how could they not come back and make good on the imbalance? Can you speak a little bit about him talking about reparations and your feeling about that idea now, where it is, if it's possible?
Well, is it possible under this under our current system? No. And I say that for two reasons. Politically, no. But as, you know, 12 to 13% of the total U.S. population, African Americans are not together and united enough to make that happen. Now, it's very possible, because when you look at, and I'll get to the broader aspect of your question, but if you look at, for instance, African American buying power, each ethnic group does have buying power. You know, now we're talking if not in the hundreds of billions, maybe trillions, you know, when you talk about consumer goods, things that we buy on an annual basis, whether it's cars, whether it's hair care products, whether it's shoes, clothing, we will spend money just like other ethnic groups. But the thing is, what I try to challenge my students to think about, imagine what are we close to, or just over 40-something million in our population. What if every adult African-American that had the means contributed $5 to a political super PAC, mm-hmm. you know, and we did that on an annual basis? Instead of Black Friday shopping, mm-hmm. we say no more Black Friday shopping. We're going to take all the money that we were going to spend for the whole holiday season, and we're still going to buy our food and spend time with family, but let's just think, and this is too radical, but I'm just mm-hmm. throwing it out there. Mm-hmm. What if we took all of that money? So what if the average family spent $500 mm-hmm. or $1,000 in the holiday seasons on consumer goods? Mm-hmm. We're going to put that in a African-American Political Action Committee, a super PAC. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to tell political parties no until you start listening to the concerns of the African-American community. Yeah. Then you'd start to see some change. But until then, you probably won't. Now, in the broader aspect of reparations, we have to look to, you know, if we were to factor in for inflation at the time that the Civil War ended, the South lost billions of dollars. You know, if we were to count in for inflation. And some businesses in the North lost money, too, because they were reliant upon the economic gains of the slave system. Mm-hmm. 1860, the average male slave, 26 years old, based on county records, because slaves were actually taxed. Average healthy male slave, 26 years old, was worth about $2,000 in 1860. Mm-hmm. You factor in for inflation, you're talking about today's standards, $60,000-$65,000. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. And so you're talking about the contributions of enslaved people, like you said, for centuries pouring in and building into an economy and not able to reap the benefits of that. And so, yes, reparations should be paid in some shape, form, or fashion. One of the things some people always say, well, no, I want a check.
Yeah.
That's the wrong way to think. That's the wrong way to think, you know. Or I want my 40 acres and a mule. Well, they're not going to give you any land. You're going to have to buy some. However, one of the things, we could tie it to education. You know, we can tie it to health care. You know, let's look to see what sovereign groups in America, like Native Americans, mm-hmm. are receiving. Maybe there can be something similar for African Americans.
And with that, we are going to take our last station break here on the Urban Connection Show. You're tuned to 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. Donna Wolf, your host, is out. Myself, Ebony Johnson, co-host, is here, along with Lyle Gibson and Jermaine Thomas, producers and director of Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. But we'll take a break, and we will come back, and we'll let some people get in on the conversation if they like to. You can dial 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. But we are going to take a station break and come back and continue on.
Thanks for tuning into KKFI. Well, folks, the future's here. Simply tell your smart speaker, play KKFI. If you haven't already, give it a shot. KKFI, wherever you are.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. And we are back here on the Urban Connection show with Lyle Gibson and Jermaine Thomas of the documentary Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. When we left off, we were talking about the idea of reparations and something that Pete O'Neill brings up in the documentary in regards to the contributions that African Americans have made in the United States of America. And Lyle was talking about having that come back in different forms, whether it be similar to how Native Americans have certain programs and various things. I'd also like the idea of people who talk about African Americans should be able to travel to Africa for free, or or complimentary, let me say. But you know, just for certain things to compensate. It's have you talked to Reverend Esther Holzendorf, who's working with the group Sankofa of Kansas City, and they are mirroring the Black Panthers 10-point plan and coming together as a group to focus on education and housing and health, etc. Are you aware of that group, or have you had any connections with her?
I am not, and I have not had any.
Okay.
I've seen her on Facebook, but I didn't know that that's what she was doing.
Yeah.
I may have to reach out.
Yeah, we had her on maybe a couple of months ago, and they had Bobby Seale actually came to... What is the church on Linwood? Something Missionary Baptist Church. Is it Linwood Missionary Baptist Church? The name escapes me right now, but it was off of like 31st in Linwood or something in that area. And the group Sankofa for Kansas City, they had Bobby Seale come and he talked about him starting the Black Panthers, and Reverend Esther Holzendorf actually called him up. One of the things she said that was chilling to me that night is she said, "I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a grandmother, I'm a great-grandmother, and I'm tired of what I see." And that moved her to act, and she thought about the Black Panthers and their 10-point plan, and they have a group working to reach back and get the wisdom from the Black Panthers and put it in action today here in Kansas City. So,
yeah, I think it's a lot of people are at their what I call revolutionary moments.
Mm.
And when I say revolutionary moments, revolution begins in the mind when you make that conscious decision to change. With that, I think we're going to see a lot of those revolutionary moments take place in different shapes and forms, you know, because everybody, I believe, is born with a talent.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't necessarily all have to do the same thing. But if we are addressing some of the challenges and concerns within our community, how can we take our talent to help better the condition, or how can we help better the community?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I think that's what one of the things Charlotte really hit home on. And we one day we said, and we was talking, she came by the studio just before she left, and she said that, you know, within each of us, she said one of the things they did was all of them came together and they figured out, okay, this is what I can do. Here's how I'm going to contribute. You know, then the next person coming, hey, I can cook, I can do this. Hey, I can clean, I can do this. You know, I can teach, I can do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came together, they just took, like Mr. Gibson said, their talent and they put it to use. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things we're missing today. You know, like I see a lot of young people, you know, and even Pac said himself, you know, we don't need another rapper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need a doctor. We need a professor. We need a teacher. We need a mother. We need a father, you know. And for me, I think one of the problems with the African-American community is we've lost our sense of family. You know, where in this one time our families were strong knit. You know, we've always struggled, but the strongest thing about us was our family. And so today we've lost that, you know, and regardless of what people tell you about single parenting or whatever, you cannot replace the family structure. It was there for a reason,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so we've actually, to me, I always say we bought into the lie, you know. And so that's why, you know, that's why for me, I became a filmmaker, because I have a lot of things that I want to say, you know. And film gives me the avenue. Like someone once told me, why don't you be a teacher? And, you know, I couldn't sit in the classroom with kids today, man. You know, I don't have the temperament for that. But Mr. Gibson does. Matter of fact, in class, we did actually have something happen. And, you know, Mr. Gibson, the way he handled it was so smooth. Like me, I probably couldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. But film allows me to be a teacher. And that's one thing Charlotte told me. She said, you know, you take what you have and you teach and you give to the community. You know, and you alluded to how we have to work so many hours, which robs us of the chance to really enjoy ourselves. And even though they went through what they did at that time, I was able to film, and you see a part of it in the film. There was a panel discussion, and all those women were on Black mm-hmm. Panther Party. And even though they went through that, there was joy in what they was doing.
Yeah.
You know, they enjoyed it. They enjoyed feeding the kids. They enjoyed being part of a revolution. And I think today, young people just don't have that. And whether it's because they don't know where to start or they don't want to, I think it's more so kind of like Andre Rethby Ross said, they really don't know where to start or how or what to do. You know, and that's up to us, you know, to teach them. So,
And I think, too, just to piggyback off of that, historically, when you look back at revolutionary moments, young people just had to do. You know, when you go back to, you know, January of 1865 by December of 1865, and the 13th Amendment was passed, and then so that started this process of 4+ million people who were set free, not counting those who were already free, black people living in this country. What do we do? Where do we go? So for many of them, and those were legitimate questions if you read slave narratives, you know, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
But for millions of them, wait a minute. We were farming yesterday.
Mm.
Why can't we farm today?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Another interesting thing, when I was doing my research, like for the film, the book and the film for Black Tie, White Tie, there were more black landowners at the turn of the century, 19th century to the 20th century, than there are today.
Mm.
So if our ancestors coming out of that oppressive system knew what to do and how to do it, it's in our DNA.
Right.
It's there.
And where we lose that at, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, and in one of Ben's classes, we was talking about this. You know, you see the shows, My Crib, you know, My Ride, right? And these guys, they're going through and they're like, yeah, I got 50 cars, you know, or I got this home with like 90 bedrooms. I'm like, I mean, what are you going to do with 50 cars? You know, I mean, Is that really necessary? Couldn't you take that and like maybe get some land or something, or create more social programs or something? But this is how this is what's being ingrained in us, you know. Whether people believe it or not, the entertainment system really shapes how we think, and mm-hmm. you really have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I remember when they was talking about this big thing about blacks getting Oscars and stuff like that, right? And after I did this film, you know, I was like, I'm not worried about no Oscar, you know. I mean, I just want to be a filmmaker.
Right.
If I get an Oscar, it don't matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not going to negate the fact of me being a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need that as validation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I know when I say this, it's going to sound controversial. I remember when they first started arguing about, you know, blacks getting an Oscar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I made the statement in class. I said, you know, if you don't want me part of that system, I'm not going to bow down and kiss you just to get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I feel like sometimes a lot of African-American, you know, people in that industry do that.
Yeah.
When they can come together and do their own. You know? We can have our own.
I think some of this, a lot of this conversation as we wind down here is talking about really coming back to our own sense of self. And what is success for me? What is a life well lived for me? What is it? You know what I mean? Not just what someone else said. And then I got trained to believe, okay, the success means this, this, that, and the other. But that's at the expense of my natural culture and my natural way of being. So it's not really success for me. If that doesn't work within my own spiritual system. But that's interesting. But I want to, we could keep going, but we can't, because we do have more radio for folks to stay tuned to. But before we end, I would like for you all to say, if people are interested in seeing your film, your documentary, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers, where can they see it? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, we're still in the process of setting up screenings and things of that nature around the city.
Okay.
But if you have an organization that want to host a screening, you know, you can contact myself or Lyle Gibson. I can be reached at, I'm on Facebook, Tashi Studios. Lyle Gibson is on Facebook. Or you can just email me at TashiStudios@gmail.com.
Okay.
And we also have a Facebook page for Legacy, Spirit of
Black Panthers, too. Yeah, so, you know, if you have an organization out there or you know someone that want to host the screening, feel free to get in contact with us.
All right. Thank you so much. Lyle Gibson, Jermaine Thomas, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson. And then later, Roots Wise Reggae with Rockin' Donna. Thanks for listening to the Urban Connection Show.